You are listening to Mark Hatmaker Rough and Tumble Raconteur. This is a grab bag of old school Western martial arts, resurrected indigenous ways and empirical musings tinged with a heavy dose of respect, admiration, let's call it hero worship, for these hosses of yore. Hey crew, this is Mark Hatmaker coming to you from the Comancheria. Today, let's talk, of course, rough and tumble fighting, as we often do. And we're going to talk about the concept of feist dogs, F-E-I-S-T, feist. If you think about it, if you hear the word feisty, we're on the same page. And we're not just talking dogs, we are talking humans, we are talking fighting, we're talking history. You know, the same old for this particular podcast. Now, caution, at some point in this, we'll be discussing fighting dogs, actual aspects of them. And if you are one of those parlor-bred dispositions that cannot encounter even an abstract such topics, we'll proceed no further. You've been warned, move on. This is a discussion of men and fellow animals that were born and bred for the itch. No hurt feelings if you got to move on from it. I get it. Seeing an animal in pain sucks. We're not going to see animals in pain. We're not going to talk about animals in pain, but we are going to talk about animals with a disposition that actually love to scrap. All right, now, feist dogs, F-E-I-S-T. Let's talk with the start with the definition. Feist dogs, sometimes you're going to see this in old journals rendered spelled as F-I-C-E. So they're obviously spelling it homophonically how they were hearing it. But a feist dog was a hunting dog that was the offspring of the Native American hunting dogs and those dogs brought over by the colonists and settlers. Now, keep in mind, the Native American hunting dogs weren't necessarily, oh, this is a specific breed this way. It was just dogs that were used for this so they could maybe more along the lines of a mongrel mix, but they had the disposition for each tribal's needs for however they were choosing to do in their hunting. Some, you know, primarily are going to be looking at buffalo hunters. We got eastern woodland hunters. We got some that are primarily being used for travaux pulling. They're actually pre-horse. These were the beast of burden. But so feist dogs were, you know, the Native American, well, pre feist dogs, Native American dogs, and we bring over these, some trying to bring over the purebred dogs and whatever, these two mixed up. You wind up with that feist. A feist dog was not so much, again, a particular breed as an amalgamation of the elements of the hunting and work dog used by these tribes and the more meticulously bred old world dogs. In the new world, it seemed like they weren't really trying to breed for a particular line. And where we know in the old world, in Europe and in the Great Britain, of course, trying to breed it down and get everything meticulously correct. Now, to some, whenever you bred, came over here and had these crossbreeds of a feist dog, this was an ungainly cur that didn't take the commands well. In other words, obedience, a little bit of shy about that kind of thing, and a lot of people did not care for them in the least. Well, to others, the feist dog was an admired crossbreed that seemed to benefit from the mix of the savage or wild elements in the so-called culture. When I say savage and wild and culture, these are all, you know, verbal scare quotes. It's just trying to show that some people just didn't care for it at all. And then the other hand, you got people, such as myself, who think these are absolutely wonderful attributes to have. So a feist dog was an animal that possessed the best of both traits, or the worst of both traits, depending on your point of view. Now, humans could also be feist dogs. We find this reference to some humans as calling someone a feist dog, or sometimes simply calling someone feisty, as in the old days. Now we think of someone being feisty, we think they're a little bit, you know, like, bubbly and, you know, maybe getting into trouble. Back then, feisty could very well be bubbly, get into trouble, but a bit more, a bigger trouble than you realize. This also refers to someone who has gone native or so-called gone savage. I mean, that is someone who was raised in the bosom of civil society, but due to the close association with the native population, they rather adopted their ways, and in many cases preferred their ways. This is a case where the frontiers kept pushing in. You found some people who were the frontiersmen who were voluntarily going that way or realizing, hey, this is a better way to live and survive in this environment, so they'd adopt these ways. We also have many, it's an interesting phenomenon, copious records of Indian captives actually taken in the midst of conflict. You know, children and men and women taken to the tribes to be raised there, and then they would at some point be bartered back to their families or their village, or they would be rescued in the midst of battle. And it's an amazing number of these captives that would return. They were just pining to get back to what was going on there. And we've discussed to some degree in past episodes and some of our blog posts about what was going on there. And a wonderful book about this also was Tribe by Sebastian Younger. I highly recommend that book. Now, to some, a feist dog human or feisty man was an abomination. It was a cur of a man or a woman. To others, they were individuals that possessed, you know, the best of both traits. Again, to some, a feist dog was the epitome of, you know, being able to survive. Feisty humans were not found in cities or townships. That's where you found the cultured, well-bred dogs, but they were found in the trackless forest, the mountain fastnesses, the arid deserts and wind-scorched plains, the frontier. The environment bred feistiness, be it physical environment or the cultural environment. This is best summed up in the words of Stuart Lake, who was an associate of the legendary Wyatt Barry Stapp Earp. Yes, the legendary lawman Wyatt Earp. He said, quote, "The frontier breeds men, good or evil, law-abiding or lawless, the pick of the strain are fighting men," unquote. And again, we see that real, that definition there floating through with Feist. It doesn't mean necessarily frontier makes good people necessarily. It doesn't make bad people, but it does indeed bring up a fighting, gritty spirit. So good or evil, law-abiding or lawless, the pick of the strain are the fighting men. Now let's discuss how this is going to keep this this thread of thought keeps moving through with the feistiness and how and the feist dogs and how people kind of wanted it as the epitome of something or saw as the epitome of something. In Europe, the European dream in the comparatively settled regions of Great Britain and Europe, there was a long tradition of holding the blending of the civilized and the wild as the epitome of the free man. Now over here, of course, we in the New World would call that the feist dog tradition. Over there, the tradition of elevating the wild man in Europe had gone by many names. It was famously rendered as the noble savage in the works of Rousseau. Rousseau's noble savage was the purebred indigenous human, the, you know, people during the Enlightenment era were encountering the New World and the Pacific Islanders and such, and they were seeing these as different, untouched by civilization. It's a bit untrue. That was a bit naive. At the same time, it's not as naive as we think. The European dream was to return to this realm while not necessarily losing the appreciable veneer of finer association. That is the perks of civilization. Now, for a really fascinating look at how indigenous thought was likely the inspiration for much of what we take as products of the Enlightenment, including what spawned Rousseau's Noble Savage, I would really recommend the book The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity by David Graeber and David Wingrow. There's so many things that we think of in the Enlightenment thought, you know, how, you know, from Thomas Paine to John Locke, to how governments were set up. You know, it sounds like boring, dry stuff, and you're thinking this is all coming off of the Enlightenment thought. And we're actually finding out how much was brought over as this cross-pollination of going, this is what we're finding in the Iroquois. This is what we're finding in the Pacific Islanders. This is what we're finding here. And these thoughts were coming over and percolating into a society that has been really living as feudal or fiefdoms. And we've got royal lineages. It's this opening up to democracy. It was actually cross-pollination of what they were finding in these tribal areas. Anyway, don't have time to go into all that. That's a wonderful book if you're interested in such things, but it's beyond the purview of what we're doing today. Now, the desire to embody, in Europe, the desire to embody what the New World frontier called feistiness expressed in philosophical tracts and songs and literature of Europe, the poetry, the theater as well. As a matter of fact, John Dryden's The Conquest of Granada contains this extract, which kind of sums up what you're going to find in this literary tradition over in Europe. At the same time, it's, quote, "I am as free as nature first made man, before the laws of servitude began, when wild in woods the noble savage ran," unquote. There's so much literature at that time that just are yearning for this return, at the same time by maintaining what you've got, the so-called noble sentiments that you've come up with and maybe so-called finer civilization. This yearning to be free, the freedom was thought to be found in this wilderness among these so-called wild peoples, an environment that no longer existed in the New World because it was done. Everything had been settled, but it was found in absolute abundance in this New World. Thusly, feist dogs can be rendered also as a blend of the Old World and the New World. And again, let's go back to Stuart Lake's quote about Wyatt Earp and everyone around him. "The frontier breeds men, good or evil, law-abiding or lawless, the pig or the strain are fighting men." Now, this also comes out, comes forward, this feist dog tradition and myth. And myth is rife with quests and journeys and ventures and crusades of the unknown. This is expressed by the esteemed scholar of myth, Joseph Campbell. He says, quote, "A hero." Okay, notice hero. "A hero ventures forth from the world of common day into a region of supernatural wonder. Fabulous forces are then encountered, and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from this mysterious adventure with the power to bestow boons on his fellow man," unquote. And that's true. The hero and the quest is the source of so many myths, so many legends, so many good tales, so many novels written today. This is, you know, hero's got to go forth. You've got to go into unknown lands and, you know, overcome something. You can come back, and things in the world can be better by what you, the hero, has. And I'm calling you a hero if you get out there and do stuff, are bringing back from it. Now, I can quibble with Campbell's use of the word supernatural, as we have no need of it in the Feistog reality that was going on here in the frontier. We can render that word supernatural into perhaps a superabundance of the natural, all these mountains and deserts and the amazingness of crossing these vast oceans. There's no need for supernatural when we're just going to go facing these wonders. And then we'll have a truth instead of a myth, an actuality instead of a metaphor. So let's have that quote from Campbell again with that frontier aspect in mind. We can just alter it a bit, and it says, a hero ventures forth from the world of common day into a region of superabundance of the natural. Fabulous forces are there encountered, and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from this mysterious adventure with the power to bestow boons on his fellow man. Unquote. Now, there we go. We're getting to the actuality of what was going on here. With that, we deal with what actually occurred. And again, to what Mr. Lake refers to, the frontier breeds men, good or evil, law-abiding or lawless, the pick of the strain are fighting men. So we've got the new world actuality to myth, and then back again. We have mythic quests in the old world tradition that become actual adventures of grit and ruggedness in the new world, and the new myths are made on top of that. But often these new myths are rooted in that ruggedness of the new world. Feistog's the amalgamation of the born and bred and the encountered and adapted. So we're looking at the European, looking longingly at the new world, where we're finding these indigenous peoples and these Feistog human beings who are the so-called Anglo society. Hey, this is the way to be. And they're saying, hey, they're kind of embodying what they're having in their own myths. And then this is where it's born and bred. And then some of the new myths that we're kind of thinking of as just pop culture figures are still coming out of this actuality. Let's look at the character of Tarzan, for example. Tarzan, Lord of the Jungle, Lord Greystoke, actually a Viscount. He was Edgar Rice Burroughs' fictional rendering of the ultimate Feistog. This is a man who's a master of civilization and the wild environment. You see, the Tarzan of the novels is no monosyllabic brute like we see in the films, but a highly intelligent, articulate human being who functions beautifully in both worlds. That's the wild world and the mild world. You know, Burroughs' Tarzan is set in Africa, which is a continent he had never visited. But Burroughs' inspiration for Tarzan, this amalgamation of civilized and being able to thrive in the wild, was actually right here in the New World home. See, his Tarzan was midwifed in observation from actual experience. Burroughs served in the 7th U.S. Cavalry, stationed at Fort Grant, Arizona Territory in the 1890s. What he saw there, the feats of frontier scouts, indigenous prowess, survival, and adaptation in the harsh deserts and mountainous territory, was a stark contrast to his Chicago Oak Park upbringing. He saw in the scouts and the indigenous peoples, the tribes there, the Apache and the like, you know, feist dogs capable of astounding feats in the wild, in the wilderness, yet also ready and able companions in the civilized, you know, environs of Fort Grant. So for his fiction, Burroughs did not want to write yet another so-called Western stories. These were dominating the market, so he altered his tale just a wee bit and other particulars and moved it to Africa, but the cast and model were found in the reality of the Feistogs he saw and served with. So in a sense, we're going, the man was inspired. He saw, hey, look at this. We're out here. We're seeing scouts like Al Sieber and such who can do all these things. It's pretty much Tarzan-esque, but just in the Southwest desert. Now let's move on to the attributes of fighting dogs or feist dogs. And I'm going to repeat that opening caution. This is where we start moving to some psychology of the fighting dog. If you've been with me so far and you're a little bit sensitive, drop out. Even though we're discussing nothing of violence here, just to make sure we're clear, we are discussing well-designed studies that we did look at dogs that fought, whether it pit, what have you. Now, there's a noted authority on fighting dogs of the world named Dr. Carl Semenuk, and he makes the following claim for wisely raised fighting dogs. Again, he's saying wisely raised. He offers that they are, quote, the best choice as a companion and home guardian, unquote. And he says this is not an apology that they're as good as non-fighting dogs. He's saying the best choice because they are fighting dogs. Now, I'm not saying that Dr. Semenuk is correct. I'm saying this is an interesting observation from a guy who's got a lot of firsthand knowledge with it. So let's repeat that and think about it. He says these are the best choice as a companion and home guardians. That's interesting then, because usually we think of them fighting and we get a lot of fear about them. And he's not saying, again, they're not as good as, you know, having your lab around there as other non-fighting dogs. He's saying they're the best choice because they are fighting dogs. And we're going to delve into why he says this. So now, bear in mind, a fighting dog is still a domestic animal. It's not a wolf. It's a civilized hound, if you will. But it has aspects that hints at its former wolfish ancestry that have been often allowed to breed and persist. In short, this is another iteration of a feist dog. Now, Dr. Semenuk claims that in his experience, the expression of loyalty and devotion are higher in fighting dogs due to the higher stakes of the bonding process. He means because they might have to fight or they have a propensity to be awareness that they might have to fight. Whatever they do bond with, it's born in the greater furnaces, that adrenalized furnace. And I'll offer an analogy to set this idea. It's the band of brothers phenomena. Those who have fought alongside one another in war or survived an ordeal together, they've pulled together through a tornado, perhaps through a flood together. These folks often forge bonds far stronger than we can build. Say someone and I who have survived a backwoods snowstorm in a subpar tent over a weekend, we kind of want to come out tighter than me and just a guy I meet and discuss Charles Bronson movies over the water cooler with. I mean, we all know this phenomenon. People you've been through things with, there's usually a bit of a bond. And that's a bit of the analogy that we're having with perhaps the fighting, though. You've been together in push and grit. There's usually a bit more bond. Now, just like I said, the person I'm in the backwoods tent with in the snowstorm, and then someone I discuss the movies with, I like both people very much, but one I aided in his survival and he in mine. Bond seems a bit tighter because of these higher stakes. And it's probably the same thing with the dog. At least that's what the good doctor is talking about. This devotion to the fighting dog is, quote, based on a loyalty that will preserve and protect its owner at any expense to itself. And that's the good doctor talking. It's based on a loyalty that will preserve and protect its owner at any expense to itself. This is a fine quality. It's a quality rarely encountered in human beings, and it's one really admired as one we'll raise the heroic level, make myths of. Dr. Simenik, of course, offers the fighting dog's superiority in guardian ability. Of course, we recognize that in this same distinction in humans. So none of us doubt a fighting dog probably does have superior guardian territory than our Dachshunds and our Poodles and our smiling golden labs. And we also recognize it in human beings, but it doesn't mean we have to avoid all fighting human beings. There's too much tendency to have a fear of them because often these dogs can still be quite sweet. But we do recognize this distinction in humans where we do know there's some people we can just like, hey, I'd like to have them around at a pinch. Here's an example. I say our car breaks down at 2 a.m. where our cell service is sketchy. It's a 6-mile walk to the next exit. Who did you rather have by your side? Dave, face buried in the non-working phone, yammering on about how they screwed up the last season of Stranger Things? Or Pam, who has eyes up, squared away, and always packs a .357 in her gun purse? I'll take Pam any day of the week. We just really people who are good guardians are ready and eyes up good. We're not talking about paranoid people. We're talking about a nice smiling dog that can also at the same time have had to turn that growl on. Dr. Simenik also offers that fighting dogs have superior adaptability. This is really recognized and noted amongst dog watchers as they're rarely subject to hyperactivity. See, the energy spent training or fighting or having the realities of the fight well inside the skull seems to lead to far less false positive barking fits, far less conniptions over nothing. Think about that human correlate right there. Many of us are lucky enough to know squared away folk who are known for doing some risky feats here and there occasionally, who display nothing but being calm, cool, and collected most of the time in the everyday so-called annoyances of life. Someone who's face down is a big thing, seldom sits in the middle of traffic and thinking, my God, can you believe this? Yeah, listen, if you can't handle the small, what makes us think you're going to be calm, cool, and collected in the big? And that's what he's saying going on along with the dogs. They're used to higher stakes, so the lower stakes don't mean much to them. We're lucky if we know people like that. We're also unlucky enough to know lap dogs that never stop yipping or peeing on the carpet, right? We're also, many of us, unlucky enough to have the acquaintance who never stops complaining or peeing on the carpet of civility. Dr. Simenik also makes the claims for high intelligence. We know all dogs are trainable. Most dogs I've ever met are mighty smart, and they're just what's lacking is someone who have worked with them. All dogs are trainable. All dogs also lean a bit into what the breed was bred for. Retrievers retrieve, as anyone with a lab and a tennis ball knows. Shepherds will spend hours corralling their toys into designated areas. And it, even though you may never take that retriever to hunt, and it's still a good dog. And you may never have a flock of sheep, and that shepherd is still a good dog. Dr. Simenik reminds us that if we are not hunting with these dogs or keeping our sheep confined, we have unexpressed attributes in them, but still, yeah, they're good dogs. The fighting dog, whether you fight it or not, is still on watch whether it fights or not. You may never put that thing in a pit, which I'm not advocating whatsoever. We're just discussing attributes of them. It just still means it has that propensity. It could be available. It's an unexpressed capability. His point being, we may not hunt with their labs or ride herd on sheep with their shepherds, but that does not prevent us from owning and loving them. The same with a fighting dog. We may never introduce it to the pit, but that does not prevent us from loving the dog, just as with the other attribute, unutilized breeds. Loyalty, devotion, guardian ability, toughness, if you will, adaptability and intelligence are the attributes of a good fighting dog. Well, these are the attributes of a good feist dog. These are the attributes of a good human, a feisty human. Humans who choose the interplay between civilization and what changes you encounter with challenging frontiers. That's where we get our feist. Let's go to Mr. Lake again. The frontier breeds men, good or evil, law-abiding or lawless, the pick of the strain are fighting men. Or back to Joseph Campbell again with our altered quote with it, dropping the supernatural out of it. A hero ventures forth from the world of common day into a region of superabundance of the natural. Fabulous forces are then encountered, and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from this mysterious adventure with the power to bestow boons on his fellow men. Well, we come to the end of this, and if you like the idea of this frontier hero's journey, or perhaps becoming a feist dog, the Tarzan in the true sense, as Burroughs observed, rather than this rendered in the page. Well, that's what this whole black box thing is about, this old school frontier combat, old school living these ways, training these ways, and trying to have scout craft in these ways and such. Anyway, if you liked what you heard here, I'll provide in the link some text version of this material so you can put your eyes on it if you want to. Links over to our store if you want to look at some of our products. And as always, I hope you enjoyed it. If you liked it, please do that with a little click there with the like, subscribe, support, share button for the podcast and all that noise. It helps out, I'm told, by the algorithm gods. Take care of yourself, crew. Well, if you dig what we just discussed today, I'd like to invite you to like and subscribe to the podcast. Hell, support it if you want. I'm not your dad. Do what you want. And if you're a glutton for punishment, just visit our website, extremeselfprotection.com. You'll find links to the blog, all of our products, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of more pages of like musics.